will all be discussed as we examine Andrews University's mobile farmers market. Garth, we are grateful that you are sharing with us today. The time is yours.
Minus 30 minutes. You're welcome. Now that she read that introduction, I'm thinking to myself, I got to figure out how to cut some of that out. Because it's you're not, I'm still trying to figure out how you guys aren't at home taking naps, because I thought that's what happened after lunch on Sabbath, but that's okay. And food equity can be a pretty complex idea to unpack. So I think that what we'll do is probably tell a little bit more in the story of what's happened with the mobile market over the last 3 years, kind of give you a little bit of contextual information, agriculturally speaking, in the county of Berrien, just to kind of set the backdrop of things, and then just tell you our story and tell you the information we learned as we journeyed down that road. So Berrien County has a long history with agriculture. Early agriculture in our county was timber. Once we farmed a lot of the trees off, we found ourselves doing many more grains, mainly because of the soil. That's kind of what you find in the Midwest quite a bit. Most of the farms were smaller farms, and we pretty quickly moved into wheat and barley, which dominated the early 1800s. Peaches, along with some technology, kind of came in to the county. A lot of that was because of our soils. And then around 1860, the Benton Harbor Fruit Market opens. So early agriculture is kind of rudimentary. 150 years later, though, we have about 1,063 farms in our county. The Michigan average per county is 281. We have 156,000 acres of farmland, and the average farmland per county in Michigan is 45,000. We have 46% of our land in farm use, and the Michigan average per county is 10.5%. And the average size of our farms are 147 acres, where the rest of the state is, the average size is about 162 acres. It starts to paint a picture for you that we're not just kind of agricultural in Berrien County. I mean, like, we really take it serious. I mean, it is our industry. It is the way of life that happens in this county. Food is produced here. Matter of fact, we're going to talk about what food is. So in terms of money, what does that mean for our county? About $161,000 was the revenue. $161 million was the revenue in 2012. It increased by $25 million from 07. To give you some concepts of what that is, and as we move forward, we'll break that down a little bit more. But about $65 million of that $161 was corn. Almost $40 million was vegetables, and that's significant as we start to look at the rest of the U.S. here in a little bit. And it's significant in terms of food. When I say corn, it's not corn that we go out and eat. That's feed corn. So really, in terms of actual food, we're talking about vegetables here, fruits and vegetables. Well, fruit and nut trees, almost $20 million. And dairy farms, $13 million. So that starts to give you some perspective in terms of the GDP of our county itself and what that means overall. So the national average fruit and vegetable production is less than 6% of our gross. So our gross crops product is, I think in 08, the last date I looked at was somewhere around $147 billion. The top five crops weren't food, they were products. Corn, soybean, wheat, cotton. And so when you start to distill that down, we start to look at actual food in terms of the nation, and less than 6% of it is fruits and vegetables as the nation average. Yet in our county, we're somewhere around 37% of our volume is fruits and vegetables. So, I mean, we're kind of the breadbasket of the U.S. almost to some degree. So some interesting statistics in terms of the state. Berrien County ranks 15th for the total value of crops. We rank second for the total value sold in vegetables, melons, potatoes, and sweet potatoes in terms of counties in Michigan. Fourth for the total land sold in fruits, nuts, and berries. And fifth in terms of acres of fruits and vegetables harvested. And we're number one in grapes. And if you look, and that's even with a lot of wine grape competition up around Traverse City. Of course, a lot of ours is juice grapes with the wine industry coming. So, I mean, we're a pretty productive county for this state. So because of Bering Farms, in terms of jobs and people, which eventually we're hoping to get to people, we have 49 food processing plants, we have 24 food warehouses, we have 3 controlled atmosphere storage facilities, 39 meat processing plants. And in terms of the people food system, we have 47.1% in low income receiving SNAP benefits. So almost half of the people in our county receive SNAP is basically food stamps, what they also call the bridge card. There's a bunch of words they toss around for the same thing. 46% of the students in our county are eligible for free lunch. 32% of our county in 2009 had adult obesity, which was type 2 diabetes, non-communicable type of diabetes. 13% had child obesity, and 10% had the type 2 diabetes, which is interesting when you think about how much fruits and vegetables we actually produce. So what's interesting about all this data is that, and I don't know how many people in here are familiar with food deserts. Has anybody heard the term? Okay, so a good number of you. There's a lot of times when I speak, people are like, food deserts, what's a food desert? So it's ironic to me that we have so much fruits and vegetables in this county, that we produce so much, that we do have the largest vegetarian restaurant in the county, and yet we have 7 food deserts. So food deserts really have a lot more to do with maybe accessibility to healthy food versus physically having it. You can have it, but if it's not accessible, which I'll kind of explain here a little bit in a minute. So a food desert is a geographic area where affordable and nutritious food is difficult to obtain, particularly for those without access to an automobile. Food deserts usually exist in rural areas and low-income communities. Some research links them to diet-related health problems in the affected population. And I think this is fascinating. 26.5 million Americans live in food deserts. So food deserts are, and they exist, because of things like transportation, right? And transportation data on America as a whole, when we start to compare it to our county, is one of those things that helps open your eyes to what some of the issues are. So overall in the U.S., about 88% own a car in the U.S., consumers. SNAP participants in the U.S., 68%, so food stamp users, 68% own a car. And SNAP participants on average are 3.3 miles from their primary store in the U.S. Bering County data is a little bit different. So this is Bering County right here, right? St. Joe Benton Harbor area, here we are here. And this is a map pulled from the USDA site that discusses the food deserts. You can go to, if you Google USDA food deserts, you can go and there's a very interactive map. You can type in any zip code and you can zoom into an area and you can see the pockets of demographics that struggle with food accessibility. So in Bering County, less than 1% of Benton Harbor's total food, this last year we did a lot of work in Benton Harbor. You can see that when you start to take a look at the county as a whole, it's one of the areas that struggles the most with this problem. And less than 1% of Benton Harbor's total food expenditures went to local businesses and local farms. The city spends $35 million annually on purchases. The household income is just a little over $19,000. I'm going to show you some census data in a minute. It's very polarizing. I mean, there's some areas down to $12,000 as an average household income. The average household income compared to the rest of Michigan is $47,000. I mean, that's a big delta right there. It's unbelievable. 60% of Benton Harbor households do not have access to a car. So the mobility problems in Benton Harbor are literally the converse, the flip-flop of typical SNAP users in the rest of the U.S. So where food stamp users in the rest of the U.S. might have 60%, over 60% of them have transportation. In Benton Harbor, 6% don't have transportation. making accessibility extremely difficult. When we sit in some of our brainstorming meetings and talk about this, I mean, we start to talk about the bus system and how expensive that actually is and how difficult that actually is. And then things like, if you don't have a vehicle and you need to go to the store, you're probably going to go to the store and buy things that are something that's going to last for a month, because you're not going to go to the store every day. If I need to go to the store, Garth needs to go to the store, I stop by it on the way home from work. That's not how it happens in large parts of our county. So then all of a sudden it starts to shift their trends, you know. They better get boxed things, canned things. And pretty quickly it starts to move them a demographic away from healthy habits because of almost no choice, and then we start to end up with having communities with health problems. Benton Harbor has more than one census tract that is USDA, that's a USDA food desert. There's actually three in Benton Harbor alone. 34.4% are obese compared to the 32% in the county, which compares to 28% statewide. So if our county is not so hot when it comes to obesity rates, Benton Harbor or food deserts, as kind of an example, is even worse. And of course, there's a direct correlation between food equity, food deserts, and health habits. And that starts to translate into things like this. 18.6% have diabetes, while Michigan's average is only 10.9% statewide. And to break some tracks down, so once I get to the point where we start to talk about some of the food deserts we service with the mobile market, these are the seven food deserts that we have in our county. So census tracts, Benton Harbor, census tract 004, medium household income, $12,068, 77% are on SNAP. Every time I see this, I do the math, because I got two teenage boys, and I'm like, you know, and my wife and I have, you know, the food budget and that kind of thing. I spend more money on food in my house than the median household has to spend on everything. Food, rent, health insurance, you name it. Blows my mind that you can even get by on that. Right. It's absolutely why they can't afford cars. And ironically, when we start to look at the data that we pulled from doing our surveys, they're not the ones who are eating at the fast food restaurants either, right? Benton Harbor Census Tract 03, median household income of $18,843, and 61% are on SNAP. In Niles, there's a food desert. $37,000 of the median household income, 20% are on SNAP. Berrien Springs has a food desert up toward town from here. And medium household income is $38,000, and almost 10% are on food assistance. And then B-Town down in Buchanan has a food desert. Medium household income, $40,000. Now, food deserts don't necessarily correlate directly to financial income. That's certainly one of the measures. But sometimes it is also stores or accessibility to stores. So how far away is a grocery store? Meijer's for Berrien Springs is a long way away. What kind of accessibility do we have in Berrien Springs? Are those stores accessible to people that are in wheelchairs or an aging community? We have a great vegetarian restaurant here at the university, but is that really accessible to the public? I mean, we know that it is, but do they know that it is, right? I mean, the deserts get defined by using accessibility, by using income. Certainly if you're broke, healthy food isn't very accessible to you, so it's one of the obvious measures. But this starts to paint a picture for us as to how a mobile market or the individuals that a mobile market are trying to help. So, what are some of these barriers? Finances, can they afford it? Physical proximity, accessibility, acceptability, will they eat it? I mean, acceptability and culinary knowledge, these are the two things that were kind of new to, they weren't new to me, but maybe I became better informed about them. Especially culinary knowledge, you know, I was told a story when I was younger about this family and the ladies, it's at Thanksgiving and she's cutting her turkey in half and sticking it in the oven. And the daughter goes, have you guys heard this story before? Yeah, well.
Cutting the ends off the ham.
What's that?
Cutting the ends off the ham.
No, it's.
But he did it.
No, right, just about, right. So the daughter says, why are you cutting the turkey in half and sticking it in the oven? She's like, I don't know. My mom always did it. So they go into the room and say, hey, grandma, why do we cut the turkey in half and stick it in the oven? And she's like, I don't know. My mom did it. So they go, hey, great grandma, why do we cut the turkey in half and stick it in the oven? And grandma goes, because my oven was small. Right? Well, now it's three generations later. I'm sure the oven's huge, but they're still doing what they did, right? And what we find in as we start to do some research is that the converse is happening. You open a box for a generation and you make macaroni and cheese, and then you teach your kid how to open a box, and you teach your grandchild how to open a box. And then all of a sudden Andrew says, hey, would you like some great carrots? And they're like, dude, we don't even have knives. So accessibility sometimes becomes what we take for granted as very common knowledge that has been drained out of a society through generations of having completely different eating habits than what would be considered maybe healthier, better options. And it's the same thing with, will they eat it? I mean, we all run into that with kids, you know, do they like it? Can you shove it down their throat? So the problem in the research, in terms of the fact that we've got an agriculture department, we've got food on campus, we've got great food in the county. The problem is, how do we get these? These are a couple of our students loading up peaches from our trees, into these, the food deserts, so that eventually we can get them into these, right? I mean, so in terms of research, I don't want to make myself look stupid, but the problem isn't that difficult, right? However, you know, the problem sometimes is, you know, deeper than that. So we did a couple of summers of research with the mobile farmers market to try to figure out how to combat this, how to break the barrier between having so much food and then having populations that don't have so much food. We were in collaboration with a handful of community folks, Lakeland Hospital, the Health Department, Southwest Michigan Planning, the YMCA, and together we're trying to combat this. And because we've got an agriculture program, they said, hey, look, you guys are the guys to partner with. So in the summer of 15, we did some research, just kind of some preliminary looking around, some surveys to try to find out what some of the habits are, the behavioral habits are. In 2016, we got a little bit deeper and we did a little bit more research. And that's kind of what I'm going to share with you today. But in 2014, that's when it starts. So we've been doing this for 3 years. 2014 is the pregame show, right? We were grant funded to start the effort. We built the market from an old FedEx truck. We talked about calling it the FoodEx, but I don't think we ever did. We gained the ability to offer food assistance, you know, so through food stamps. At this point, the state had something called Double Up Food Bucks, which was, I mean, there's so many different programs trying to encourage this demographic and to assist and help. One of them was, if you use your food stamps at a farmer's market, the state will support you dollar for dollar so that you're actually getting twice. It's a two-for-one deal if you're shopping at a farmer's market as compared to a corner store. Because of the difference of what you're getting and putting in your body, right? So we had to go through all the vetting and make sure that they know that we were okay to take food stamps and that we were really a farmer's market, even though we weren't a standalone farmer's market, you know, we were mobile. We primarily used produce from the farm, our own farm at that point. We were growing over 100 varieties of vegetables out in the gardens, and we were using mostly our vegetables. The truck served two purposes that first year. We were a mobile farmer's market all but Thursday. Then on Thursday, we were delivering our CSA, which we were kind of trying for the first time as well, community supported agriculture, those baskets that were going out to homes in the community here. We served all seven food deserts that first year because we were going to fix everything, right? We were just in 1 year, we're going to fix it, we're going to be done, and then go home. We did it for 16 weeks. Everything was new. Everywhere we went was new. If we had to make contracts to park our truck in somebody's parking lot and we had to create kind of an agreement with partners, we had to get the health department to approve our truck because we were giving demonstrations on cooking and recipes, and you can't just cook and feed people without. So everything was new. That first year we were scrambling to get everything new while we solved world hunger. And we finished the summer with our first snapshot of the mobile farmer market and larger questions about our customers and what and how we were doing. And we had all sorts of measures that we kind of took a look at, and we were like, you know, I don't know if we're successful or not. However, I kept having conversations inside of those meetings with the community leaders that were encouraging us along. And I was like, yeah, I don't know, because it seems like success, you know, it's not what you see. We want a community that's going to be healthier. Well, buying from our market doesn't necessarily mean they're healthy. I mean, you could have somebody walk down the road and say, and go home and have dinner and say, hey, Jim, you know, I saw that market out there today, and they're right. We really should be eating a little bit healthier. And there could be personal choices going on inside a household that we would never know about, because this stuff works so slowly. So we were just, how, you know, what success are we having, right? So 2015, we tried to be a little bit more purposeful. We tried to put a little bit more intelligence into our operations, and we tried to maybe make some small adjustments from 2014. And we also decided, you know what, we need more information. At the same time, our community supporters were really pushing us hard to do another outreach incentive, which I'll kind of briefly talk about here in a minute. So in 2015, we had stops in Benton Harbor only, because we were like, look, we're not selling a lot of produce. People like it, but we're not making any money. We can't live on this forever. They're like, well, let's just narrow it down to Benton Harbor. It's one of the biggest problems in our county. Let's figure out how to do it there. And then we'll start to move it around to the rest of the county, right? Let's get it right once, and then we'll move it on. In 2015, we started with a survey. We did a lot of surveys that year, and we started to ask questions about habits, trends, desires. You know, what's the biggest barrier for cooking healthy at home? Time. Who is the one who does all the cooking in your house? Usually the woman. How many incomes do you have? If you listed your top 10 vegetables, what are they? So kind of some questions like that to try to figure out, you know, what are the habits? What are the barriers? What's the meaning behind the meaning with the folks that we're trying to engage with and be as helpful as possible? We focused on partnering with the local community. We are outsiders, whether we like to think about it or not. And we were already doing things to try to engage with the community. We had internships that were bringing young folks out of the community to work in the truck and in the farm, so that was kind of reciprocal. We were starting to get to the point where we were creating some relationships, because we were having to park in people's parking lots and driveways and stuff. And it's a very tight-knit community, many of these communities. And because they don't travel 5-10 miles every day, they're, you know, it's like a family. And all of a sudden, there's these people that aren't family that are kind of hovering around. And we realize we really have to have some partnerships. We're not going to do this alone. There's a lot of energy behind it that many of the community leaders agree with, and we just need to feed on that. We had cooking lessons. We had samples. We had educational flyers. And then they also said, hey, can you test a CSA? So this is the mobile market. And then the CSA was the same thing, the same CSA that we had here, where you buy into a program at the beginning of the year, and we will deliver a basket to your house every single week. But it wasn't easy, but we figured out how to package it in a way that we could still get food assistance and double up food bucks, so that they were able to get a CSA basket for basically half price, use their food stamps to pay for it, and then, of course, those who were even less mobile, maybe an aging demographic, this was being delivered directly to their house. Trying to break as many barriers as possible. So it came with cooking classes, the CSA came with home deliveries, it came with incentives, and it came with failure, unfortunately. And again, I mean, that's one of those things. You know, you're doing something new in an area, and that just because it's my good idea and I think it's great doesn't mean that the rest of the world thinks it's great. So the CSA was a little bit of a flop. Mobile market still did pretty good in 2015. So we gained some data at the end of it, where we did a survey of all of the users at the end of the season. They had to have shopped at the market more than once. There was a couple of things that they had to be. They had to be local, you know, so on and so forth. And this is the information that we found from them. 93% were preparing a vast majority of their meals from home. It's not a surprise. 64% cooked from scratch daily, which that's almost a trick question, because apparently what we think is from scratch, or what I think is from scratch, I guess, and what somebody else thinks is from scratch is different. You know, so when I think from scratch, I'm chopping a vegetable, right, and I'm making something. You know, scratch might be boiling some rice and putting some topping on it that comes out of a can for other people. 78% had meals that resembled the food plate. So part of our research was to try to find out what their health habits were, or in this case, what their perceived health habits were. So we had the new food plate, you know, a little picture, and said, you know, do you eat one meal a day? Do you eat six meals a week? Do you eat, you know, three meals a week? You know, how many meals do you eat that look like this on a weekly basis? We had a bunch of answers for that. 78% said that they were eating their meals that looked like the food plate, which would think that they're healthy. 71% almost never ate fast food. Of course, they're poor and they don't have wheels, so I don't know why they would. But yet, everybody's saying, oh, look how bad food deserts are. Look at all the fast food restaurants. And I'm thinking, well, maybe that's not what it really is anymore, right? 77% were eating. So we asked some questions to try to find out the food plate, and then we asked some backward questions that said, okay, well, how many servings of vegetables do you eat a day? So many a day, so many a meal, so many a week. And we found out that even though they said their meals were looking like the food plate, really 70% were eating less than the recommended servings. So the vast majority of them actually weren't eating the vegetables they thought that they were eating once you actually measured things. 64% live within the mile of our stop, so we decided that we were actually hitting the demographic that we were supposed to be hitting. 57% shopped at our stand multiple times a month, or some on a weekly basis. 100% loved our stop and would come back. 97% said that they were eating more vegetables that summer than they normally were eating, which I think is fantastic. And 100% felt that the market helped them eat more healthfully. So generally speaking, from a human feelings perspective, right, they were feeling like this was serving them. Thousands were served. They just published something in Michigan, some journal recently, that talked about 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people that we served that summer. But we weren't making any money. It's not a surprise that you're going to take a tomato, right, that you're making 50 cents on, and you go sell six of them to people that, you know, can barely afford to keep their lights on, that we're probably not going to make a lot of money. But we weren't. So our work was generating excitement, but not profitability. Grants are good for beginning projects, but I find them very difficult for sustaining projects. They want to give you some money, and then they want you to go and get out of their face so that they can give somebody else money to start other programs. But they're not going to give you money every single year to keep your pet project going. And the community also, as we sat in the steering committees, I mean, they wanted to support this type of development, but they had goals that at some point this was going to be self-sustainable, self-sufficient. So we had some heart-to-heart conversations. At the end of each summer, at this point, this is my second summer, right around October, November, I would come back with reports and say, we served so many people, we made so much money, we had so much SNAP benefits served, we did so many double up food bucks. This is, you know, these are the measures of what we did. How do we want to move on to next year? And at the end of 2015, after 2 years, we were kind of forced to ask some tough questions and remind ourselves that there's a difference between need and demand, right? And which was kind of my thing. I was like, hey, man, you guys are killing me. You're like telling me that I need to sell more vegetables because people are sick in our communities. You're the community leaders. Create demand. Can you create educational programs or put billboards up or something like that? They're like, yeah, that's not as easy as it sounds. And there's a difference. Just because somebody needs something doesn't mean that they still have the demand for it. Because, I mean, anybody in here from the business department? Yeah, maybe not. Okay, there you go. So clearly, if there was a demand in Benton Harbor for fresh fruits and vegetables, there's probably going to be a grocery store in Benton Harbor, right? There's a reason that there's not a grocery store. There's a reason that it's not accessible. And it kind of comes back to this guy right here. We get this. They get this. We all get that. That doesn't make that. So there's a difference. We had to remind ourselves that when it comes to such habits, the difference between intentions and actions, you know, there's a difference. You know, going back to food plate question, yeah, I want to eat more vegetables, and this is good, and this is what my food looks like. Well, do you do it? No, not so much. And how do you change? How do you create social change with something like that? That's tough. Decades, we'd remind ourselves that decades of social norms don't get fixed in 2 years of an intervention. It took years to get to this point. It's not going to take months or to get out of it. We had to ask a question, you know, that funding wouldn't likely outlast the time needed for the social change. That's one of the things that we started to had to remind ourselves of. At this point, we're realizing that we're going to need a long time to try to help resolve some of these issues, and we're going to have to figure out probably some other kind of funding source. So, in a county with so much food production and a neighboring segment that is near developing country status, so if you look at the finances of Benton Harbor specifically, and then you start to look at the finances of places like the Dominican or areas of the Dominican, Haiti, other countries that are not first world countries, we actually have a third world country in our community. So you start to take a look at the fact that we've got food right next door to a developing area. Maybe the problem's something bigger than we're even realizing, right? I mean, maybe this needs more time to take a look at it. So this all formed the questions, you know, how do we break the barrier? How do we get local food into neighboring homes with need? How do we educate and encourage habit change? And knowing it's a longer struggle than we would actually like it to be, how do we fund this guy? So this is the conversation we're having in a meeting with Be Healthy Berrien, which is the conglomerate of organizations that lead this from the community level. So, you know, maybe a problem isn't always what it seems either, right? So the two summers of research, is when we go from 15 to 16, 16 starts to take on a completely different look altogether. We started with the same stuff, though. We started with students that I find are generally smarter than I am. And we started with the same groovy, souped-up FedEx truck full of local vegetables. So we kind of had, like, the same idea, right? But then the question was, okay, as a matter of fact, what precipitated from that conversation was they're like, all right, Garth, look, you know, we'll fund you for a while, and I'm like, I don't want you to fund me for a while. I want a system that's not broken, you know? I don't want to rely on funding forever. I'd like to have real systemic change in the community. And they're like, okay, well, we need to figure this thing out. And I'm like, and I don't even feel like it has to be me. You know, I'm happy to develop a business and then hand it off to somebody in the community to run. It's about the people that we're trying to serve. But it needs to be sustainable. I don't like looking at it like this when it's not sustainable. And they're like, yeah, we're not going to pay for this forever. But what we will do is we'll pay you to figure it out because we can't figure it out. As a matter of fact, what happened was we were having all this circular conversation. And they're like, well, listen, you know, Grand Rapids, they run their mobile market all on volunteers. And this place over here, they do it this way. Well, what if we did this? And what if we tried that? Like after about 45 minutes, everybody's head's going to explode in this meeting because there's 1,000 ideas down on the table. And they just stopped and they pulled their hands back. They're like, look, here's the deal. Let's fund you this year just to figure it out. Why don't you take next summer, the 2016, and why don't you build for us 3 different business models based upon this conversation, based upon what we've learned for 2 years, based upon the fact that we've got some barriers still to break. Build those models, figure them out, and then test them for 2 weeks each. And we want you to come back next fall and tell us what the next step is. So we benchmarked other markets. We built those 3 models to meet needs, local needs. We tested those models for 2 weeks each, and then we had recommendations that had some sustainable options. That's what our goal was. This is Kesh and Hannah doing some of the food samples. You know, we're not going to have a lot of time to talk about everything today, and I feel like the students are going to totally get swept underneath the rug, which is horrible because we're a university and we're here for them. I'm telling you, the students did everything. These were dietetic interns. We had a public health intern. We had an extremely brilliant cognitive psychologist intern that ran it. And these guys, man, they got some crazy experience. I mean, they had to deal with a health lady. They had to go through inspections. I made them make recipes. And the recipes were horrible, so I made them do it all over again. They had a great time. Great time. So last summer's research kind of had this flow in terms of how it was going to go. You know, data collection, qualitative data collection. You know, we're starting out with what are all the different markets doing, and if we're going to build three qualitative models that we can take a look at and say, here's business model one, here's business model two, here's business model three, what are we basing this on? So we did that, and then we built the models. We tested the models, and we ended up with some qualitative data. Well, this model made this much money, this model made this much money, and then knowing that it was still going to be broken, we cycled that data right back around, and we shoved it right back into the models again to start this all over again. Okay, well, we started with these models, we found out this information, and here's how we're going to have to adjust those models for them to move forward. Model one, so now you're going to get to the good. So when the county said, build three models and fix this for us, we were like all crazy innovative and trying to learn along the way. So model one was what we call the value-added products model. I'm not going to read all this. That's a little bit boring. So I'll tell you the model. So the model was, why don't we go to the fact that a mile or two away are businesses, St. Joseph, there's an affluent community. What if our truck actually tried to make some money? And then when we were done making money, we used the surplus to fund evening philanthropy, right? So we created a lunch truck. And this lunch truck had vegetarian wrap, so it's still, I mean, when we sat down in May, me and the students met every single morning for 2 hours for the month of May. And we would sit and brainstorm and have conversations. We'd have guest speakers come in, a sociologist from on campus to talk to us about the trends. They would go out and take a look at other mobile markets and then bring that information back. We'd digest it and spin it all around. And one of the ideas was, and one of the things we did in terms of, we followed the steps of a business model just for the academics of it, you know, and we created a mission and we created a vision. We did all that kind of stuff because what we wanted to do was have three models that still were following and trying to solve the exact same problems, each of them, and that we're still following the mission, right? That we weren't straying away and getting off track. So we had vegetarian wraps with the thought that we're still trying to bring some, you know, educational knowledge into the community, but maybe a different community, you know, open their eyes to other options. And we sold these wraps at lunch as we had a couple of stops. Lakeland was one of our stops. They've got a branch out of town, not close to food places. The YMCA was a stop, a farmer's market was a stop. So we did the wraps at lunch to serve a community that could afford to buy $6 or $8 wraps with the idea that we're going to take the surplus from this, and then in the evenings, the same people with the same food, with the same truck, they're going to go into the evenings and set the same little market up, except for it's going to have a sample station instead of a wrap station, and it's going to be, here's what kale salad looks like. And the dietetics interns worked really, really well with doing things like using products from our little mobile market stand, you know, cucumbers and tomatoes and cilantro, and they would make chilled cucumber tomato salad, and they would say, if you get this bag with this recipe, this can be your salad for the evening. So we were trying to break all barriers as much as possible. So same truck, same concept, but not selling wraps in the evening, selling ideology, selling health. Very successful. As a matter of fact, I was the second day that we did wraps. The community is so supportive in St. Joe. It's been unreal to work with these people. And the one of the ladies that sits on our board is kind of oversees one of the satellite campuses of Lakeland. She said, yeah, set the wrap truck up in our parking lot. It'll be great. We'll love it. So she sent out emails, and she had people send out emails for the wrap truck rolls in. And I kind of get there the first day to try to make sure that these guys know where to set up. This is the second day these poor students have been on the truck in real time. And a flood of people come out. Within an hour, they had made like 30 or 40 wraps, and they were completely unprepared. They were like running out of food, and there's people running back on the truck, and this is like, it was like the worst kind of success you could ever have. I mean, it wasn't. They loved the food, but like they started coming out in the lines out there, and those students were just like, oh my gosh, what have we gotten ourselves into? Totally freaked them out. I was running around trying to get food, go back and forth. It was too funny. So the wrap truck was very successful. The second model was the free supply chain model. So when we were developing this in our little group, and of course we've got a farm on campus, we're agriculturists. One of my colleagues, in kind of some snarky moment, says, hey, the farms have seconds, they've got extra fruit, we've got 40-some percent of our county, how about they give us the vegetables? And I was like, that's a really good point. How about you go to the farmers and ask them to? And he did. And they did. They were completely supportive. I mean, these things have a shelf life, and not all of it moves that fast. And they definitely get to a point where they might have seconds or extras that they're more than happy to share with the community. We don't have a system at this point in our county to get it from those farms into the inner areas of the food deserts. So this kind of became that bridge. So the idea was, well, this business model is going to be great. We're going to get all of our produce for free, and we're still going to sell it at a competitive price. But we're going to do that so that we can pay the driver, and we can pay the fuel, and we can pay for the packaging, right? And we strictly stuck to residential areas. You know, we're going to be in the communities. We're not selling wraps in this model, right? We're just selling produce to food deserts. That's all we're doing. And we're going to do as many stops as we can in this model. And we're going to get the produce for free. And that's going to be the way that we fund ourselves. Pretty successful. Still did the education. The dietetic interns still were there at the edge, making samples for people to try and answering questions and saying, oh yeah, well, this is that kind of vegetable. You cut it like this. Plenty of handouts on different recipes and things they could do. Model 3 was driven by a presentation that we got in one of our little early morning Monday meetings in May, where I had a sociologist come in and tell us about Benton Harbor. I mean, we think we know, but I don't know. I understand implicit bias. I understand that I'm completely ignorant to many of the things that happen outside the world that I was raised in. Tell us. So we started to talk about it, and we accidentally stepped on the dynamics of poverty. Am I just a mess up here or what? And we've identified what we call the ALICE population. Is it spell out? Yeah, assisted, limited, income, constrained, employed. Well, I don't even know why we come up with things. I don't even know what that means, right? I can tell you what it means. So poverty is on a spectrum, okay? There are people who are so poor that they're couch surfing. That's the term that they use for the most of the time. They don't have a home, they don't have a refrigerator, they've got $2 to their name. They're almost the guy who's pushing the basket around in town with his stuff in the basket. As a matter of fact, they might have been doing that last week, and today they found a friend whose couch they can sleep on. That's this end of poverty, right? And then the ALICE end of poverty is, they're not that broke, right? But maybe they didn't have the education that some of us did. Maybe they didn't have the opportunities that some of us did. Maybe they have two kids and they're a single parent. And they're on the end of poverty where they do have jobs. They do have drive and motivation. But they don't make enough money to necessarily to support their small family. They're making $8 an hour at McDonald's. There aren't job opportunities. Maybe they didn't get educational opportunities, but they're trying really hard. That's the ALICE population. We pretty quickly realized that the ALICE population was our target market. Because the couch server doesn't have a refrigerator. There's other people need to help that person to get them to a point where our little farmer's market can help them, right? So the ALICE population, we started to map them, and we used a little bit of GIS, and we said, okay, well, where is the ALICE population going, right? Well, they still have jobs. They're going to WIC to get their benefits. They're going to SNAP to get their benefits. They've got a couple of jobs in town. They might not have cars, so they're probably going to be working on the bus route. Along the way, or at least using the bus route in many different ways. So we're like, okay, well, we're going to target them, and we're going to set up shop outside of where they do daily business. So not the home so much, but where they interact with the community. So this was churches in the evenings, because they're still very, very active, right? So churches, right outside where they get benefits, some of the larger work areas, and we targeted the ALICE population. So here's the results. The overall revenue from the market for 2-4-6 weeks was $2,600, and Model 1 led that sales because of the wraps. The wraps really, really did well. When we stopped doing the wraps after 2 weeks, my phone wouldn't stop ringing. I was getting heckled by people going, hey, what happened to the wraps? Well, you can still come down to our place, can't you? They're like seriously trying to get me to like, you know, work a deal with them because of the wraps. I was like, no. This summer is research. This next 2 weeks, I am focusing on residential areas. Don't call me again. They kept calling. The overall EBT, so EBT are SNAP or food stamp, and FB is double up food bucks. So our overall food assistance sold was $503, and Model 3 earned the most by far. So again, Model 3 are the ALICE population. So then we had a total visitors over 6 weeks of 1,600 visitors. And Model 2, so we were in the community, so we were seeing a lot of people. We were interacting with a lot of community, but they just weren't buying product. So we saw them a ton in Model 2 where we were in the community. We just weren't getting the EBT sales and the direct sales. It wasn't, you know, being successful. And this is kind of how the finances worked out. We lost money. That's okay. I mean, any business that's going to run for 2 weeks is just going to lose money to begin with. I mean, you have to be around for a while and create a good client base. And technically, I mean, the university didn't lose money. This was all grant funded. But this is the little P&L, the profit and loss for each one of them. And you can see, so Model 1, we generate a ton of income, but boy, was that costly. And it was costly because I was paying the interns, and they were working their tails off. But it was just costly. It had a lot of demand. Model 2 didn't sell much of much, but we didn't spend a lot either. I mean, we spent a couple hundred bucks less. So Model 3, we sold more, cost us more. So anyway, so they kind of broke even, but we still learned from them. And I don't know if I want to read this either because it is starting to get late. So here's what we learned. We do have discussion, we do have recommendations, but I'll sum it up for you. The wraps were extremely successful, and the idea of having a truck that could make itself some money, and then instead of using that to further itself as some fantastic business or open up more stops or to pay for some large overhead, use that money to fund evening stops with the same mission. So that kind of like stop sequence works really good. So lunches, do some wraps, evenings, same people, same produce, but different market. However, in those evening stops, it was clearly that we needed to be addressing the ALICE population. We needed to just move ourselves away from trying to really feed the world and solve all hunger issues, and just probably solve the ones that we really could handle. So address the ALICE populations, get into their churches in the evenings, get into the communities where there's some housing facilities. These were some of the places that we stopped, and work with the population who was trying to raise families and get themselves up out of the pits. These are the guys trying to make wraps in the truck at one of the stops. This is what the inside of the truck looks like. So our goal next is what? So I don't know. So there we are. 2017. Questions?
Show me your hands and I'll bring the mic to you.
We had somebody over here and over here.
I was just going to ask, so what is your plan for 2017? Do you have it?
Yeah, well, we did exactly what the research methodology said. I mean, we've circled back around, we've taken the pieces that stunk and we've dumped them, we've taken the pieces that worked successfully, we've basically built a third model based on the recommendations. And one of the recommendations that came from it was, you know what, Model 1 was successful, but it's really costly. How do we cut costs down? Well, we've got a lot of interns. There's colleges all over the place with interns. Interns can come cheap. So we're building an active intern program so that we don't have to pay them a bunch of money. We'll have a market manager that gets paid. So we've built a model that's based on that kind of combining of good ideas. Let's sell some sandwiches. Try to do it for probably 16 weeks. We've got a couple of other barriers that we're trying to break. Students go back to school in August, yet produce keeps coming. And guess what? People need to eat 12 months out of the year, and right now we're only serving about 3 or 4 months. So we're not done breaking the barriers, but we're done with this step. And we're gonna, so our next step is to take the information that we learned, build a successful truck for one summer, and do the whole thing one summer. One, you know, to beginning to end, building a customer base, and then take a really close look at it next fall. And we're being funded again, but at a much smaller amount. So like in the past, when we were asking for maybe $40,000 to $60,000 to $80,000, this summer we're going to be able to run the market on community funds of only $12,000. So we're cutting our grant demands down this summer already, which is really good. And in terms of environmental sustainability, by the way, nobody can touch us. Can't touch us. There's no packaging. We're not keeping a bunch of stuff in refrigerators. It's not being shipped from Arizona. We're going to the farms. We're picking it up. It's going into a little box. Somebody takes it home in a bag. Our environmental impact is almost next to nothing. We tried to track it. It was almost hard to track. I was like, no, how many boxes are we using? And they're like, Garth, we're not using any boxes. And I'm like, okay, keep track of the boxes.
The problem, I think, is the culture. Anybody heard me talk about it, this is the answer. As I see it, and I discovered 25 years ago or so, that capitalists seek to serve and the socialists seek to get. I believe Jesus was a capitalist, and he always talked about healing people so that they could work.
Right.
I look at this thing here, and I really don't see the problem. It's the model, and you're doing lots of research. And what you said was the demand.
Yeah.
The people that you're working with in these food deserts, they're deserts because there's nothing there. The Sahara used to have lots of trees. Haiti used to have lots of trees.
Mm-hmm.
When the trees are cut down, nothing can grow.
Right.
All tangibles grow out of real estate, and all intangibles rest on attitude. I think if you go there and get the people who are having the problems involved with the solution, instead of paying other people who are subscribed and locked into the culture following models that don't work, reach out to businessmen, and I'll give you my card, and I'm probably not the best businessman around, but I've bootstrapped more than one business, and I don't see this here as an insurmountable challenge by any means.
It's not, and that's what we started doing in 2015, is making partnerships, and we work heavily on the partnerships, both from like a from the perspective of sociology. You know, we're not, you know, we're strangers coming into a very tight community, as well. And like I said earlier on, I was very clear with the steering committee. I was like, look, I don't feel like I have to be the guy that's running this. If we've got somebody in the community that we can support to do that, and we can start to find somebody in the community so that this growth is coming from within, it would make me happier. Had a long conversation about that, and that's been tried many times in the past, and there just wasn't the feeling there was going to be a lot of success that way. So we've been working with the communities, and we continue to do that. So like when we work when we're bringing food inside of kind of some low-income housing developments, we're doing so with a great deal of conversation with the people that are already in there and that are running the housing. And so same thing with places like Mosaic. There's a couple of fairly active businesses in town that are either finding jobs and that are working with people that are already actively trying to get themselves up and out.
I would like to suggest that regarding culture as the problem ignores the fact that this is a different culture that by and large we don't understand in our middle class fairly comfortable surroundings. I did work in Benton Harbor for a couple of years and discovered very quickly that I could not make the same assumptions about the people I was working with as I might have made before I worked with them. We couldn't assume, as you mentioned, people don't have knives, people don't have measuring cups.
Right.
I believe in the WIC program, but I also find that it ignores the fact that people eat in families, people live in families, and the WIC program goes to individuals. I believe in it, I supported it, I worked in it. I think it's a wonderful program. But there are a number of things that are different, as you mentioned, and we can't look at people and say, oh, you should change your whole lifestyle because I think you should. I'm impressed with what you're doing, but I find it interesting that you're apparently, and I could be wrong on this because you didn't mention it at all, not involved with the PMC food pantry. I'm not sure what the food bank downtown, how you might interact with that. It seems to me there'd be some value in working together with the other existing programs and...
I can answer that.
Okay.
So we did, I mean, when we originally started deciding on stops, we said, hey, why don't we go to stops where they're already serving food, right? I mean, because then we're partnering with something that's already happening. They already have a stream of customers that are coming in. But it circles back to the Alice population. Those who are coming to places for free food didn't want to buy from us because they're coming for free food and our food wasn't free. As a matter of fact, we ran into that a number of times. We found that working with some of the bread pantries and the free lunches was actually negative. It wasn't the demographic that we were trying to reach. It wasn't the demographic that was going to be successful. And we also got to the point where we said, look, I mean, we can't fix all demands. We can't feed all people, right? There's other programs that are working on some of those things. What we need to do is figure out where we can bridge the gap between county agriculture and a demographic that really does need it. I don't care if you tell me that I think they need to need it, maybe I don't understand. I mean, there's data that talks about health issues. I mean, it's such a big issue that it's not so much of a question. The question is, how do you combat it? And how do you educate? And how do you raise that demand? The food pantries and some of the other partnerships just weren't successful because they weren't coming for food unless it was free. Right. They either couldn't afford it or that's not what they were there for.
I'm interested in two things you mentioned. One is that you taught some cooking. Mm-hmm. Cooking skills, and also you see the need for long-term intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if, and of course this may not have to do with your selling of things, but did you think of working with the churches in the area in which maybe in some of those churches they're familiar with small groups, and that usually change comes in small groups that support one another in these changes. I wonder if that model would help in the training and changing of lifestyle.
Yeah, so that's where we're finding a lot of our Alice population is at the churches. So if the church was having an evening event on Wednesdays, we were partnering with the pastor, and that's when we would set our truck up. They communicate through those means. That's kind of their family and their niche. So yeah, we've done quite a bit of work with the churches in the evenings. And as far as the cooking, we try to incentivize it. I mean, Whirlpool was giving us all sorts of free stuff, and And we were housing them in the community centers, Virginia Edwards Center, in some of the churches. We were housing the cooking classes in those and trying to tie them to incentivizing. I just don't know if it's quite there yet. It's gonna be a longer haul.
I mean, I can't believe all the things you've been doing. It's just exhausting hearing you do all these things. And I know that every little thing you do and every person that you work with takes time. Mm-hmm. You know, these committee meetings and getting people together and this and that. I'm just amazed and impressed with all of the things that you have tried. I mean, I've been in the business of trying things and failing, and I know just exactly what it's like.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know. No, I agree. It's like, we call them business models, but I feel like that's counterintuitive, because any bright businessman just wouldn't do it, yeah. Right? I mean, but it's not. We're trying to create social change, and we're trying to do so through something that is somewhat self-sufficient. And again, the idea is, hey, can we come up with some snappy, new, innovative way to solve some of these problems that can maybe then be duplicated in other areas? Because just people don't like to give their money away for things that get lost year after year after year.
For a moment, when you are presenting and you say, what next, I look at the two pictures there, and what came into my mind was probably thinking that you had plans to have the people involved in production themselves. I know this is a very difficult thing to think of, but the element of sustainability, it should be an issue that probably you may think about it. Maybe also it's not the culture of the people to think of producing, because that's not what they're used to. But in the long run, I think it is something that probably we may need to think of. We tried a program like this in California and in churches, in the neighborhood, starting some small community gardens for the community and neighborhoods around San Bernardino, where they don't have sufficient quality food.
Right.
And it was a little bit difficult to start at some point. You find some people who have not even seen a tomato plant they don't know where the tomato come from.
Right. I've got stories about that,
yeah,
that blow your mind.
But after some time, you know, people start and then they begin to appreciate, and yeah, they start with the children, we're doing horticulture with the children, and they started learning where to find, how to get these things. Even if they get the food, whether it's not free or free food, where they buy it, but thinking of teaching them how to produce it would probably be a long run option for them.
It is. And they've Benton Harbor has a pretty, I don't want to say active, they've tried very hard to have an active community gardens program going on. They've started it, made plots on some empty land. It kind of got walked away from pretty quickly. So it is one of the pieces that is in this cog spinning around and around, and it is actively going on. Some years more successful, some less. I actually tried to get involved with the high school because we were looking at having some land donated right next door to the high school. They had an ag program. The guy that was running it was a friend of mine, and we were like, hey, look, you know, we can get the gardens going, your students can grow the food, I'll buy the food and we'll move it around to the market, or they can sell it right here. There's a little bit of dysfunction inside the politics still, and many of those things are arduous to move forward and very slow to move forward. They're happening, seeds are being sowed, but it's really slow to move. Part of the thinking here is, look, we've got people that are growing vegetables really good already all around this county, right? Well, why don't we just, you know, harness that resource and just figure out how to bridge the gap? That was kind of our thinking, in addition to some of those other things that are already happening, yeah.
2 weeks is not long to create a demand, but did you get any feedback from your target population, the Alice customers? Did they come to you and ask you to continue?
Yeah, so as a matter of fact, in 2015 we ran into that a lot too. This is one of the things that we're running into, is that, I mean, it's very simple. Those who are using the market are super excited about it, are really glad we're there, see the value in it, appreciate us, want us to come back, are very regular customers. We have a very strong demand inside of our customer base. It's just that it might only be 1% of the population. So we need to be around longer. The word needs to get spread. Other activities need to happen in our food deserts in our county in order to educate. So the demand is very high from those who are using our market. There's just not a lot of people doing it. They were begging me, please come back next year. Yeah.
Thank you for that very thought-provoking presentation. Andrews is in the right place to do this kind of mission, and it's really, truly mission. Thank you for the presentation.
You're welcome.